My name is Jillian Music, and today we're going to talk about the future of entrepreneurship. And the future lies in diversity, because a mutt is always stronger than a thoroughbred. So we need more diverse founding teams, we need more diverse ideas to be built, and we need better ways to get our money in and out of corporations that are being built today in order to build a full ecosystem. It's not just about the unicorns. Why I do what I do. So many people ask me about that. And I would say that I build better ways to live and work together. At this stage of my life, I can write a check to the Red Cross. And if I'm lucky, 10% will get where it's going. Or I could build companies. I'm pretty good at that, it turns out. Somebody asked me just the other day something about the cusp of what I did and so on. I thought, you know, if I died tomorrow and everybody showed up, 1,000 companies would say she had something to do with our ability to launch, grow, pivot, or thrive. I'm going for 2,000.
Let's go.
This is the Blind Entrepreneur Podcast, where we help entrepreneurs and business professionals execute their vision by guiding them to profitability. Today, we have Jillian Music. She is the CEO of Outlines Venture Group. OVG advises and consults early stage impact ventures. They lean in by mentoring and supporting diverse teams worldwide. Jillian, how is your day going?
Absolutely wonderful. I'm talking with you.
That is a good answer, and I respect that answer. Calling all the way from Seattle today, correct?
That is right. Seattle, Washington, where the weather is as you would expect it.
Before we
they call us the Emerald City, you know.
Of course, yeah. And I've traveled there, and it is absolutely beautiful, and the weather is always, like, perfect. So, before we get into all the fun stuff about your life, your business, your habits, and successes and even failures, we have to start the podcast off the same way we do every single time. And that's with an icebreaker. So imagine you just had the absolute best day of your life. Where are you going to eat, and what are you going to order in order to make your day complete?
I will be in London. I will be at, think hard. I will be at the Hyatt Regency, the Churchill in London, right? And I will not only have a great dinner, but the most important part is when I'm done, I go around the corner to the Churchill bar and I order a cigar.
Nice. That is a great answer.
But I really
want
to do it.
Honestly, that's the first time I've ever got an answer like that. So I totally respect that answer. Very cool.
You're invited.
Yeah, I will take you up on that. That's for damn sure. All right, so the first real question is, tell us about yourself. Who are you and what is your story?
Okay, so I'm the CEO at Outlines Venture Group now. It's a very small company. It's a lifestyle company. I built Moz, known originally as SEO Moz, and now it's the world's most popular provider of digital marketing software. I had a happy exit in 2012, and that's what you want, folks, a happy exit. So no bones about it, right? When I stepped down, I took enough off the table, which makes me, I know, incredibly fortunate. It means that I will not worry for the rest of my days, but it doesn't significantly change my life. It is the job of the folks I left behind to make me a billionaire before I am 90. And I would just like to put it out here. The operative word is before. Okay, now that we got that, right? You're all invited to the party on the yacht if they make it happen. In the meantime, though, it was a good exit. It was solid. And so what do you do when you grow up, right? So a couple of things. I was having, appetizers. Well, it wasn't even. We didn't have appetizers. But my friend Ann Kennedy and I were well down on a bottle of Pinot Grigio without the appetizers along the Oregon coast at the sunset. We were having a very fine conversation, and we were talking about all of the scalable stuff that needed to be built in the world of surge marketing. She was to services as I was to software in the world of search. And we both had a happy exit at the same time. So now we're deciding we're going to worked together because we were friends. We met on the road while we lectured all over the world on behalf of our companies, and all of that was great. And finally, she looked at me and said, I hate development. And we decided that we had earned the right to have a lifestyle company. So that's what Outlines Venture is. And we decided, you know, what were the goals of this company, if you will, for us? What did it have to deliver to us? And I would say that's probably my first tip to the folks listening. Figure out what you want your company to do. Not everything has to be a scalable corporation that will become a unicorn, right? By its very definition, the moonshots are moonshots. So decide what you want your company to do. First thing we decided was we had traveled the world for about 5 years each. And we'd spent, I don't know, I did anyway, 250 days a year on the road. We'd made wonderful friends, and we'd like to go visit them. And we ain't flying coach. That's goal number one. Number two, the company has to provide that capital, right? And number two, we would like good food and good wine, and we'd like to share it with those friends. That was it. We didn't get to number three. That's all that company has to do. So that is, we understand, an extraordinary leisure. But you should be doing the same stuff. Ask those questions and figure out what your company has to provide you. How much in hard cash, now, in the future, whatever it is, and how many people it must support. Yourself only, or you and a partner, or you and a partner and a whole bunch of people who are going to work for you. Figure it out. Once we had done that, we determined what we would want to do. And these are all issues of legacy at our age. They're very different issues when you're 20 or 30 and 40 and 50 and so on, right? But I'm 63. My partner is older, right? We have the leisure to build this company. We don't have to, how should I say, we don't have to build a company that goes on forever. So the issues of legacy we looked at were, what kind of went right, what went wrong in our own business careers? What would we like to do? Being mothers, each of us, of three children, so being a middle-aged mom with three kids under my belt, playing a game that young boys out of college played, and yes, it was boys, not girls, in large, large numbers. We're talking 90-something percent. I said, well, you know, lots of people have asked me for advice already. Just in my role at Moz, you know, my airplane ticket doesn't work. I've got the snuffles. I can't get my presentation to print. And would you listen to my business idea? Lots of business ideas ran across the desk as I went around the world. And I just leaned in and helped them. That was fine. Now and then I would serve on a board of not really directors at that point, but boards of advisors. And I'd get a little bit of stock or options. And she had the same thing. So we put walls around it. We put those into a box and said, all right, now let's decide who we want to invest in, what we want to invest in, and how we want to do it. The who are diverse founding teams. First Round Capital made that study for us. 10 years of investments, and now they're doing it again around 20 and so on and so forth. They said, you just put one woman, just one, on your founding team or your C-suite and the board. Right, and you will return 63% more ROI to your investors. 63%, you would think the money would follow the money, but it doesn't. 2.19% of venture capital money went to women in 2016. Highly unacceptable. As Sheryl Sandberg says, the numbers are awful and they're going in the wrong direction. That's something we can work on. Diverse founding teams, it isn't only about gender equity, it's about racial equity, ethnicity, origin, all kinds of things, and it's even around physical mobility, right? I know exactly one CEO in a wheelchair, and we're having a hell of a time getting that guy funded, right? It's about the whole spectrum of the human race. So that's the first thing we do. The second thing is, what do you want to fund, not who? And the what is kind of in our byline. And our byline says, we build better ways to live and work together. In 1997, 1994, actually, the web showed up. But by 1997 through 99 and so on, we were asking millennial questions. We have a universe unfettered by the laws of math and time. How shall we populate this universe? What an extraordinary thing to live in a moment like that. To be alive at the moment in which this universe, truly unfettered by these laws, is now to be launched. And we talk about it like a religion. The cloud, right? It goes up into the sky. All of those things, right? Wonderful. But those are millennial questions, right? And we look for the unicorns in them. Now, in 2017 and moving onward, we already have the pilings in place. It's much more of a flat earth, right? Now we have a table on it, right? It's like, how shall the pages of the web be organized? By 97, it was evident that the pages of the web shall be organized by search engines, and shortly around there, you know, Google showed up. The early players had been there, the AOL and Netscape and all that. But Google showed up, and the neighborhood of other search engines showed up around them. It's like a piling. It's big, fat, more like a mountain, if you will. So that's number two. What do we want to invest in? And how? We look at very early stage founding teams with diverse founders, which I say is a proxy for the ability to, if you will, take in diverse ideas and to act upon them instead of being single-minded. Right? That's an important thing to success. And we lean in with this mentorship in exchange for a small piece of equity at the very early idea stage. And we bring those companies through the Series A. Sometimes we invest capital. We ask our friends to do so and so on. And I've got exciting news. We actually are going to form a fund and organize that now after 5 years at Outlines Venture Group. Very so cool. That's what we do.
Very poetic story. And I have a couple of questions. The first thing that comes to mind is your vision to what Outlines Venture Group is. To what Moz was when you first started, was the direction of the company as clear as it was now when you created Moz? And what were some of the initial periods of your time when creating Moz when you were blind in your business?
Always blind. And if you're not, you're not going in the right direction. Right? But here's the thing. Have you seen the TED Talk by Simon Sinek? Almost everybody has, right? It's not about how, what, and then why, but why, how, and what. And that's how I describe what we did at Outlines Venture Group. If you can answer the why, everything else falls into place. You may pivot 10 or 15 times, but everything follows that why. At Moz, it was always clear. We do not make esoteric B2B software that helps marketers do their job. What we do is to democratize the spread of ideas on the web. And that is the motto, if you will. That is the goal of Moz, to democratize the spread of ideas. It is lofty, right? And the way we do it, how we do it, is to provide a tremendous amount of free education, which happens to this day, that Moz blog and the Whiteboard Fridays, all of those kinds of things, the what's, right? Those are still available. And we have free tools. They are still available. And we have very low entry prices for those who want to begin. But if you use this stuff and you learn that stuff, you can compete with the behemoths, with the elephants in the field, whether you're in politics or you're in, I don't know, retail, right? We think that the corner shop should compete with Macy's. We think that the, you know, the first idea should compete with whoever is in the White House. Those are the kinds of things about democratizing the spread of ideas on the web. So the why we do it and then the how we do it are two different things. The hows largely stayed stable at Moz. I don't think we ever had a feeling that we had to do a major pivot. We began with software, and we had developed tools that would serve our needs as providers of SEO. And when we decided that it was time to share those tools, the first time we did it free, then we sold a few of them. And when it was evident that we had signal, which was a few months after we had launched the paid service, we had more than 100 clients, right? That was signal, and we shut down the services because you do not compete with your own customers. I mean, people do, but not me, not Rand. So that was the hard line. And then we proceeded with those tools. So then exactly what tools, how we deliver, whether it's this price point or that, whether we provide, I don't know, onboarding services or not, those are minor. That's the tiny little what's. Right? So it was clear.
So when I think of content marketing, I first company that comes to mind is Moz. And Moz has been creating content, providing free education, pretty much was the first organization to start that trend of giving all of your secrets away for free in anticipation and hope that somebody would pay pay it forward by becoming a customer. Was at what point in time did you guys see that this content marketing and this giving economy started to work in your best interest, i.e. getting more customers?
Okay. Pretty much immediately. There is a difference between a client and a client wannabe. A client wannabe wants to be a client, but doesn't want to pay. Trust me, folks, you don't want any part of this ever, right? So ignore that and run from it. Those will be the clients I will counsel you to fire at the end of the year, right? Always fire your bottom four clients. They take up the most time, and you think you desperately need them, but as soon as they're gone, trust me, much better clients will show up. Maybe only one or two, but they'll pay you three times as much, right? So the client wannabe syndrome is something I wanted to avoid. And I learned that lesson much, much earlier in my career. So I was fortunate that I had that under my belt. Trust me, it's about the only thing I knew. Everything else I had to learn on the fly, and I was really, really bad at it, right? So, you know, I made just enough right decisions that we survived and got through hell. But the rest of it I had to learn on the fly. But seriously, you don't want to run into that client wannabe stuff. When, you know, if I tell them, then they'll want to do it themselves. Fine, let them go do it themselves. What we were really doing was growing our own farm. If you tell people what to do and how to do it, even if they can do some of that themselves, they will quickly realize they have a business to run and they don't have time to do this particular job. If they're a real client, they will say, those guys know what they're talking about. Let's use them. And we did a little bit of it and it worked. Or even they didn't do a little bit of it, but it was evident that we knew what we were talking about. We weren't blowing smoke in somebody's face. So we saw that immediately. And I would counsel anybody in any industry to follow suit.
Very good.
You get clients and they'll pay you.
No, that's a great answer. Some things that that I'm curious about in hearing your story, was Moz your first venture, or does entrepreneurship stem all the way back? So take me back to like the first cheesy business that you created.
I raised three children under my desk. The youngest will tell you the color of the blanket he slept on under the desk. So I mean it quite literally. And we still have that little blanket as well. But as they grew, I was able to grow the business a little more. It was simply a marketing play. I worked with SMBs in the neighborhood. I would do a little marketing planning. I'd make an ad here or there. In 1984, I put an Apple II on my desk. The Heath Zenith Company was selling them. And they did it by saying, take the thing and put it on your desk and then bring it back in 2 weeks if it isn't what you really want. And I thought, well, I better really learn about what the hell's going on here, you know, and this stuff. This is 1984, mind you. And I had a newborn daughter at that time. That was my middle child. And I thought, well, I've got more self-control than that. I'll just do that. I'll figure it all out, and that's fine. But I don't need this sort of thing, right? And in 2 hours, it owned me, body, soul, and mind. And I never gave it back, and I paid for it. So that's how it works. I thought that was pretty good on the Heath Zenith part. But the object was just to do something while the kids were growing up. I figured if I have them, keep them. I didn't want to farm them out too quickly. And that was fine. As they grew, I had, I don't know, a small marketing company, a regional thing. In 1994, actually, I became involved with MarketLink International. We were the first international commerce center on the World Wide Web, and that's how I became the grand dame of internet marketing. I was there 4 seconds before the next guy. And it was new. The web was literally a week or so old, and we were scanning business cards in full color and popping them on that fresh new web. We were so full of ourselves. It was so much fun, you know? It was about international commerce, and by the time we were done, we had real-time human translation. There was no such thing as a Babelfish or a Google Translate or anything like that, but we had real-time human translation of international traders. I could see the face of the trader in, I don't know, Shenzhen, and they could see the face of the trader in Seattle, and they would get the translation and they could hear the timbre of the voice. And that was crucial for these negotiations to happen. And I thought, you know, we do not kill those with whom we trade. This is our next best hope for peace, because until the Klingons show up, we're not going to figure out that we're one human race. And they're probably not showing up next week. So this was my inroad. It still gets me up in the morning. It puts me down at night. I am still smitten by the advance of this truly disruptive thing, and it was the web, not the computer, not the desktop computers, none of those things. It was the web, the ability to be anywhere on the planet in a split second. That communication is powerful.
And I think that's so cool, just talking to you, hearing your voice. I could hear the excitement and the joy of what the internet brings. My question is more so a personal one. I could tell by the way you're answering questions and talking that you're very that you're incredibly intelligent and also extremely artistic. Do you have any type of background in the arts?
That's my degree, fine arts and architecture, and I fell in backwards. There wasn't any job to be had in that when I graduated. It was Columbia University. It was the early 70s, and there were no jobs to be had. So I ended up doing marketing for Vox Productions. Vox became 3M, Moss Music Industries, but at the time, Vox was the only standalone classical recording company. Everything else was a tax write-off for something else, even Columbia Records, you know. This guy had it on his own, and I started out there, and I designed record covers, and then I kind of managed the production of the music and so on. It was a wonderful experience. I had a really good time, but I never really used it again. I mean, kind of, I guess, as a little marketing thing. Put together ads or something, but it turned out that that was not my field at all. Turns out that I'm an executor to a brilliant wizard, and I talk about executors and wizards all the time. The wizard is the idea person, right? But they generally cannot market themselves out of a wet paper bag, let alone put the structure around to have a scalable corporation. The executor executes on the idea of a wizard and builds the company around them. That's what I do. Turned out I was good at business. But I did it without a business degree, without a marketing degree, with none of those things. It was insane for me to have tried what I tried, right? It was, like I said, every bad decision in the book, but just enough that we made it.
What are some things that we can learn to become a better executor? Because there are a ton of visionaries and there are a ton of people that are listening that are entrepreneurial and CEOs, but they may not have that fortitude to push themselves forward into that next step in entrepreneurship. So you could say it was born within you. I could see both ways that it's born and taught. But what are some things that we can learn and teach so we could teach ourselves?
Right. There's some of it, and some of it is experiential and so on. One's, you know, early life kind of puts you into certain roles within a family, within a community, within your college, even that sort of thing. So you become better at certain pieces of it. Maybe an analytic mind helps. But I would say the things that you can learn, it's not unreasonable to say you would want to sit in on some of these classes around, truly around business management, organizational structure, and so on. But the web is also full of tremendous amount of free information. You can literally read your way through that kind of an MBA. So I would start there. Experience helps. So having peer mentors is critical. And it's not just the people who are at the same level, but those who are just slightly beyond. Another year or two in business, maybe a little bit more expansion. If you're going global, find somebody who's already done it. You know, it's dark out there. Take somebody's hand, you know. When I was at Moss, I didn't have mentors. I didn't have advisors. I had no startup ecosystem, and it was pretty dark. There were months, let alone weeks, when I would walk the streets and could not pick my head up off the street. We were in terrible debt, and I had done a really bad job, and I didn't really see how I was going to get out. I would say one of the things that saved the day, if you will, was this unwavering gut feeling that we could not fail. And I can't tell you why I thought that, even in the face of all evidence to the contrary. It didn't give me hope. I mean, it was, how should I say, it was very dark days. My head was in a really bad space, right? But it gave me the fortitude to keep going. It was just, you must do this, keep walking. And if you can walk through the darkest of that stuff, that mire and muck, you do come out the other side, and it's worth the trip. It's fully worth the trip, not just the cash, but this ability to say that you have accomplished these things to yourself, not to anybody else. Doesn't make a hill of beans. It really is if you want to accomplish it yourself. Right? And then hopefully you are leaving the world a better place than you found it. Now, all that said, there would be an awful lot of counsel that would tell me, you should have declared bankruptcy, you should have folded along the way, even though I made it in the far side. Right? And I kind of didn't, right? I mean, I made all these mistakes and whatever, and somehow it worked anyway. But there was this unwavering gut sensation that despite all the voices to the contrary, the right path was to keep moving. And those who do that, kind of push that final extra piece, often do get where they're going. I know that this is the case in sales. People who are true salespeople go, well, the first 12 no's, you know, that's just, you got to get through those. You know, just put them on the list. And others are saying, how the hell do you get through no 12 times just to begin the process? Because you may get another 8 or 10 or 15 or who knows what before you finally get a yes. But a salesperson will say, no, that's just the ante. I'm going, maybe there was some of that. I don't know for sure.
That's interesting.
Okay? I would say, if your gut tells you and all the voices are telling you otherwise, perhaps you know something they don't know. There is a financial risk tolerance that entrepreneurs have that others don't have. And it often leads them to say, cut and run. Don't do this, right? Why don't you have a government job kind of thing, right? I mean, my mother would say, you know, she does something with Google. I don't know. I mean, one day she'll get a job. You know? How many of your mothers are asking, when will you get a job, right? They're still asking. Mm-hmm. I am that mother without a job, right?
Yeah.
Right. So I know enough not to ask, but there you are. You're raising your hand. You've got one,
I'm
right?
There. Yeah, I'm right there.
It's hard to keep going when those voices that you have trusted all your life are saying, I'm looking out for your better good. Don't do it. And you have to say, I'm doing it. I'm walking this path. So
it.
Reach out to your peer mentors. They're the only ones who will hold your hand through that. And it is blacker than anybody can imagine who hasn't walked through it.
Incredible advice. Something that I've been thinking about is the future of marketing. Moz has so much data. I'm sure you have so much data in the venture that you're doing now. What do you see is the future of marketing? And where do you think it's going to go?
That's a good question. I've been out of that field for some time, so I always refer those things to the Mozzers. But I'll try to answer just as...
You can even answer it in terms of entrepreneurship.
Right. So I'm going to say yes. In terms of being an investor, the question is, what do I look for in that sector if I want to put my money down on a venture? And I think that the answer lies in predictive analytics. Avinash Kaushik has been talking about this for years at Google and pointing out that somewhere between, I don't know, 60-70% accuracy and so on, thousands of data points, we're still not that good at predictive analytics. But I was in Dublin for Web Summit, and I met a fellow by the name of Akhil Sharma, who had a company called JuiceWorks, which says to me the guy is definitely an engineer, because nobody would have named the company that. It's JOOSWORKS, JuiceWorks. And the product he has is yogurt. Don't even ask why. It's spelt like yogurt. Anyway, the bottom line is this guy can perform predictive analytics of random activity. If you give him daily activity of random stuff, right, for 20 weeks prior, he will give you the next 7 days' numbers, right, without even knowing what the industry is. He does it with chaos theory. None of the other data is involved. It's pure mathematics, and it's downright biblical. It lasts for 7 days with well over 95% accuracy, most of the time 97 to 99, getting better over time with just the numbers. He doesn't need to know what the industry is. You can use it for things like HIPAA and healthcare and, I don't know, stuff for the government. I mean, all kinds of things, right? Because he doesn't need to know what it is. Just give him the numbers. That kind of breakthrough blows me away. So he can tell you, for example, how many people are going to download your app next week. Now that you have a baseline, you can run some kind of a campaign and lean in on it. You'll know exactly what that cost and what it yielded, right? The other way, we never really had a baseline. Once you have one piece, you have a second piece of data. If you run something, it's obviously data-driven in the improvements of data, but it's this kind of predictive analytics that can send you over the edge. So on the eighth day, it kind of falls apart because it's chaos theory. And it goes down to, I don't know, 87, 90%, whatever. It still blows out of the water the stuff we do today. But it's little stuff like that that's happening all over the world. This guy lives in Gurgaon in South New Delhi, right? And he's blown it out of the water, and Google couldn't pull it off. All right? IBM Watson couldn't pull it off. So those things are very exciting to me. I believe that the future of marketing is not just personalization, but data-driven, predictive analytics for that delivery of content. It's not what did I look for yesterday, it's what do I need tomorrow.
You started the we're going to start the end the podcast the same way we started the podcast. And I do have one final question, the question I ask for everyone at the end of this, so be ready.
Okay.
You started the podcast saying about diversity and women in business. Being a woman in business, what are some to the women, to the people of diversity that are listening, what are some pieces of advice that you would give to those individuals that are maybe hitting that not hitting the stride and having some setbacks and maybe having some sexism or racism within their current role? What pieces of advice that you could give to those individuals?
Right. So I won't give you any platitudes. I will say that I'm working on that solution. The more female funders there is, the more female founders will be funded. There is a direct causation, not just correlation. And I would say find those female funders. Also find the funders who are diverse in their nature themselves. The venture capital world is run by tall white males. And with a baritone voice, right? The pitch process favors a tall, American-spoken white male with a baritone voice. And if any of those pieces are missing, you've already taken a hit. This does not mean you can't win. It does not mean that the system isn't changing, but I would look for them. There are many groups now that are finding the female funders and putting them together. Chloe Capital, Elevest, Golden Seeds, Astia, and now Outlines Venture Group. Those are just five around the country, and I know there are many more. I would find those folks first. The second thing would be to, how should I say, to be a little more strident, right? I'm tired of the platitudes that say, just keep working hard, you'll get there. And if you're worth it and this and that, the next, nonsense. It is not so. The questions that venture capitalists ask of men are different than those they ask of women. The words they use to describe the male entrepreneur are different than those they use to describe the female entrepreneur. Be aware of it, listen for it, call it on the table. Be, how should I say, not outrageous, but be strident in your confidence. Right, because somebody doesn't understand what you're building does not mean that what you're building is not highly scalable or even possibly a moonshot or that unicorn company. But it will often be dismissed. And if you seek out diverse funders, you're far more likely to get somebody to understand where you're coming from and where your customer base comes from. For example, OfferUp is a company that is run by Nick Hazar. And in 2010, he came to me for advice. I was still at Moz, all the money was wrapped up, and I had nothing to write him, but I advised him. Serena Glover, here in Seattle, Washington, a woman with significant financial capabilities, wrote him that check. And she told me, she said, Jillian, it is not women who don't get funded, it's women's ideas. She said, I wrote him the check, and I had to keep writing the check. Now, she's got some clout in this town, and she dressed him up and she took him to the ball, and she could not get that boy a dance, right? Because it was a consumer play. Consumer plays. It wasn't artificial intelligence, it wasn't IoT, and it wasn't, big data. It wasn't the soup du jour. right? If it isn't the soup du jour, nobody's funding it. On the flip side, they couldn't see that women control 95 cents out of every expendable dollar on the planet, and this is a consumer play. You didn't think there's money in there? To her benefit, she owns a large chunk of a $1 billion company. But it was a tough go. There are others walking your path. Know that they do. Get together with those that do. Here in Seattle, we have an F-bomb breakfast club for women who are building these scalable corporations, and they're not enough that you can't, I just said that you can just run it alone. You've got to find your mates. That's where they meet, right? And now I'm building the funders. And again, it's not only about gender. It is about the broader sense of equity. So we're getting intentional about the deal flow, intentional about the funding. And no, we don't go down one whit on the ROI we expect. We expect extraordinary ROI because we are working with diverse founding teams. I believe that's the future of investment. We're building better ways to live and work together.
And not just the better ways in investment, but the better ways of living life. It's just collaborating and using each other's resources to the best of our abilities.
Why only eat vanilla ice cream? There's 1,000 flavors out there. Get out there and live the world.
Couldn't agree more. I do have one final question, and I'm curious to hear this answer. Being the seasoned veteran entrepreneur that you are, if there's anyone that you would like to meet, who would it be and why?
I would like to meet Angela Merkel. She's held the reins on some pretty tough times with colleagues who are insulting, deprecating, sometimes supportive, and sometimes ridiculously unsupportive. Mm-hmm. I think everybody knows who's who, right? But she has held the reins for a very long time with a sense of duty, structure, order, and, if you will, the public servant, right, rather than holding a line with the hubris, if you will, interviewing herself when she wants to know what someone else will think. I'd like to meet her and to have a sense of where she gets her center, right, because she is centered. You don't rock that person. And yet she's not filled with a, you know, the world is black and white. She will change her mind if the facts are presented differently and she, you know, now agrees with it and so on. She has no problem with that. There is a depth of wisdom there. I would love to meet her. That's it.
Jillian, you successfully completed the podcast, so thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thank you guys to those who are still watching and listening. Thank you guys for always liking, commenting, and subscribing. Jillian, without further ado, if you could just take the next 30 seconds and tell everyone about how they could be a part of your journey, how they could be a part of your mission, and learn more about all the things that you have working on.
Absolutely. If you are a funder or you know someone who is a funder, male, female, any color, any race, any creed, national origin, any gender, I want to meet them if they also want to fund companies that are building better ways to live and work together. That's number one. Number two, the founders. If you have a diverse founding group, if you have a company that doesn't necessarily fit into either IoT or AI, we'd like to meet you. We'd like to know what you're building. We do not fund just locally. And we do lean in preferentially with female founders because we are females who walk that path, and that's where we give back. We just say, let's even this playing field just a little bit. And I have a very large Rolodex. It doesn't have to just be me. I've got lots of people who can help. So don't be shy. We find that, again, far more men ask for it. Far fewer women think they are worthy to ask. I'm just saying, you're worthy.
Very cool. And all of your links will be in the show notes so then they can learn more about the website and what you're doing and this amazing cause. Again, guys, thank you for always listening and watching. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on YouTube and also head over to theblindentrepreneur.com for more interviews. Being blind in business is temporary, and I hope that after listening to the wisdom of Jillian today, you are now able to see more clearly. Go out there and execute your vision. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much for watching this video. Don't forget to follow me on any and all social media platforms using the long last name above, followed by the letter J. If you want to get lost into the dark abyss of YouTube, click either left or right for another video. And finally, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. No, seriously, don't forget.